One Migrant's Harrowing Story, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hamza and her family fled Syria's civil war, and after a dangerous trip by sea and by land, they're now stuck in Hungary.
They stopped us. They didn't let us go out to the train. I don't know why we are obliged to stay in this country.
I ask a State Department official for a response.
It is heartbreaking. It is difficult. It is urgent. We're doing a lot. Do we need to do more? Yes, and we're looking at how we can ramp up our efforts.
Plus, a Guatemalan writer hears that his president has stepped down.
When I heard about the resignation, I just belted out a scream and then had a shot of tequila.
But what's next for Guatemala? Those stories and more today on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. If it was about the safety of your children, you'd do anything for them, right? Well, that's at the root of what we've been covering all this week on The World, Europe's struggle to manage the arrival of hundreds of thousands of migrants. And what do those migrants want in Europe?
I hope to stay at home, small place, me and my children, my husband, have nice work, have something to do, help others.
Just one woman's simple wish list: home, family, a job, and to help others. We've told you about the vast scale of this migration, hundreds of thousands of people on the move. But today we're going to focus on one person, the woman we just heard from, Hamza. She's Syrian, a teacher, originally from the city of Homs, but she was forced to leave along with her husband, two daughters aged 14 and 18, and an 8-year-old son. My BBC colleague Matthew Price caught up with Hamza and her family outside the main train station in Budapest, Hungary.
In Homs, the situation is too bad. No electricity, no water, no good circumstances to live in. We can't go out, we can't go to school. We went to Damascus first, before Lebanon, and then stayed there for 1 year and a half. And also, but the circumstances also became too bad. The salary cannot be enough to buy anything, to buy food, to buy clothes, anything. So we moved to Lebanon. We tried to go to schools, but also in Lebanon, gradually the situation became too bad also for the Syrian. So we left Lebanon to Turkey. We tried to do something in Turkey, but the language is too difficult to learn. We don't have any job, and the house's rent is too high, and the people, they hate Syrians.
How many places have you lived since you left your home in Homs?
Oh, too many. Can't be counted. In Damascus, one. In Lebanon, we stayed for 4 houses. Yeah, in Turkey, 2 or 3 also. Just going from place to place in order to have a good future for our kids.
So when you left Homs, you weren't planning to try to come to Europe?
No. No, I just want to go to Lebanon in order to go away from the war in Syria.
How did you leave Turkey?
We came from Izmir to Greece by small boat from rubber.
A rubber dinghy?
Yeah, and we were going to die, to sink our... go into the sea, the water was to here.
Up to your neck?
Yeah, and we throw all our clothes and things, medicines, clothes, everything. We lost everything. Even money, even everything. We lost everything.
Let me ask your daughters, can you swim?
Little.
Swim.
Yeah. Little.
You can swim a little bit.
Yeah.
What was it like in the water?
Oh, really bad.
Yeah, it was really bad.
What were you thinking?
She was thinking about death, and she was crying and saying, God, please help my family. My cousin was holding 4 children with us, holding them up from the water. It was horrible, terrible. I can't believe that we arrived. We thank God that we arrived safely.
So you arrived in Greece. When was this?
About 10 or 11 August, we arrived on Mytilene,
And then from there, you went to...
We went by a ship to Athens.
To Athens.
Yeah.
So why did you decide, after 4 years of traveling, to leave Greece?
In order to go to Germany.
Why Germany?
I have my relatives are there.
Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did you travel to Hungary?
Oh, my God. كيف رحنا على هنغاريا بعد ما رحنا على من أثينا. We went first to Macedonia, then to Serbia. We were running according the borders, and the police were throwing bombs on
us. The tear gas.
Yeah, yeah. It was terrible, terrible, through the forest and across the rivers, jumping across the fence.
Cut.
You were cutting the wire of the fence.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you worry that you would become split up as a family, that you would lose each other?
Yeah, we tried to hold each other and run.
You were holding hands all
the
way.
Yeah, yeah. We tried all the time. And I was trying to push him in front of me. If I stopped, if the policeman stopped me, it's okay. Just I want to be my children to be in safe. If I don't cross the borders, it's okay. Just I want my family in safe.
You were prepared to be separated from your daughters to allow them to go?
I have to. I don't want to separate them, but if I'm obliged, it's okay. Just see they to be safe. We tried today to go out from Hungary. They stopped us. They didn't let us go out of the to the train. I don't know why we are obliged to stay in this country. We don't want to stay here. The police told me that Germany is closed her border. They said that it is a political matter. They told me that.
And how do you feel about that, when for you this is a matter of your future life and you're being told this is about politics?
I will tell you. All the governments make this war on Syria. I don't know why, but they have their hands. They put their hands in everything, even in the war. And now they stop us and prevented us to go to their countries. So where we go? Where we go? We can't stay in the war. The president there will kill us. And they will do something bad to my children, to my daughters. I can't send them to any school. And the other countries stopped us and prevented us from going to their countries. Even the Arab countries.
Do you think you will make it to Germany?
Yeah, I will make it. I will try.
And when you get there, what are you hoping for?
I hope to stay at home. Small place, me and my children, my husband, have nice work. Have something to do, help others. Future, another future. I wish I could bring my family from Syria. Yeah, my brothers, my mother, father are all there. I wish they would be okay. I'll try to bring them for me. I don't know if I can, but I wish. Terrible way. We have been now about 25 days in this way. I hope we will do it.
I can't imagine. That was Hamza, one of the thousands of Syrian refugees in Hungary right now. She was speaking to my BBC colleague Matthew Price outside the main train station in Budapest. When you hear stories like that, it's hard not to think, why isn't Europe doing more to help people like Hamza? Also, why isn't the U.S. government doing more? Mark Toner is deputy spokesman at the State Department in Washington. I asked him how many Syrian refugees the United States has admitted since the conflict began in 2011.
I believe our current numbers are somewhere between 1,500 and 1,700. That's by the end of 1,800, rather, by the end of this fiscal year. That means by the end of this October.
So we spoke with the nonprofit group Refugees International yesterday, which is also monitoring the situation. They believe, best of their knowledge, that the number is between 800 and 900, certainly under 1,000. But even if it's 1,800, as high as 1,800, we're talking 11 million people who have been displaced. I mean, it really seems like a drop in the bucket.
Well, again, these are asylum-seeking refugees Certainly, what you're seeing in Europe is, frankly, a broad array of refugees seeking shelter, seeking, frankly, any kind of relief. But you're right, it is a huge situation right now, and certainly we're watching as it unfolds in Europe. But we've already put more resources into accepting refugees for permanent asylum in the United States and resettling them here. And we've actually upped our numbers on that front.
Yeah, how many is the U.S. committed to taking now?
Well, again, what we've done is we've gotten over 17,000 refugee resettlement referrals. That's from the UNHCR. But certainly, you know, one of the problems in any of these kinds of processes is the fact that they have to undergo a fairly stringent security check. And that's an important element of it. But that can take time. That's a long process, sometimes 12 to even 18 months.
I mean, given the urgency, why isn't that process being speeded up?
Well, again, we're putting more resources behind it. We're looking at that and trying to, frankly, speed up our response. What's also important here is what are we doing in terms of humanitarian assistance? And the U.S. is the largest donor. We put almost $4.5 billion to assistance of refugees, both within Syria, but certainly outside of Syria, places like Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere.
I mean, President Obama says he's committed 100% to helping these refugees, but it sounds like the money is not necessarily doing what a lot of people would like to see it doing.
Well, look, let's be very clear. We've seen some, I would say, heartbreaking images out of Europe the last couple of days. Certainly what we've seen in Hungary, but the image of the child in Turkey washed up on the beach to any parent and frankly to anyone are heartbreaking. And it speaks to the urgency of the situation. We're doing a lot. Do we need to do more? Yes. And we're looking at how we can ramp up our efforts. And certainly, you know, the longer term goal here is we need a resolution to the conflict in Syria, within Syria. We need a credible peace process.
I mean, the political process, as far as Syria goes, feels like it's been stalled for a while. The bombing campaign, a lot of critics say it's just a stalemate. It's just a bunch of bombs, not really doing that much. What about the moral imperative here to help as much as is humanly and logistically possible for these refugees?
Well, again, you're right. I mean, we need to do more, but we're already doing quite a bit. Again, we're the largest single humanitarian assistance donor at $4.5 billion.
Sorry, I have to interrupt. Yep. When you say that, and we know that there are maybe 1,800 Syrian refugees that have been admitted to this country, it doesn't sound like the United States is doing everything it can.
Well, there's several aspects to this, and it's important to keep that in mind. You're talking about those seeking asylum in the United States, and that is a separate process. And as I talked about, it is not one that is easily done. It's not something that can be done overnight. So what we're trying to do is provide humanitarian assistance to those refugees, both in Europe, but also in places like Jordan. Certainly Turkey's been dealing with this, who are displaced. And then again, the other piece of this that I already spoke to is, you know, trying to peacefully resolve the conflict in Syria so that these people can eventually return home. Those who want to can return home.
Mark Toner is a deputy spokesman for the State Department. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mark.
We've got more coverage of the story later on the world, including a photographer who asks migrants to open their backpacks. One man's bag revealed a few clothes, a toothbrush, and some lemons to help ease the symptoms of seasickness. And that got the photographer wondering.
First, I thought, well, why don't they just take, you know, anti-nausea pills? And I realized, well, they might not even have water. And that was an incredible realization that it can get that desperate.
The things migrants carry, that's coming up later. Plus, a young Afghan rapper who used her music to escape a child marriage finds a new home at a private school in Utah.
I think it's a great school to get education and a safe place.
How Sonita Alizadeh is adjusting to a new country, a new school, and unlimited amounts of pizza. That's still ahead. You're listening to The World.
The World is supported by LegalZoom, dedicated to providing legal help to all Americans through online services, personal customer support, and legal advice through independent attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. When author David Unger won Guatemala's National Literature Prize last October, he used his acceptance speech to criticize President Otto Perez Molina. The Guatemalan-born author told the president he should resign to face corruption charges. Perez Molina resisted calls like that for months, even as protesters took to the streets day in and day out to demand he step down. Well, this week, the president finally resigned, and he's now in jail facing corruption charges, just as Unger wanted him to be.
When I heard about the resignation, I just belted out a scream and then had a shot of tequila. There's such euphoria surrounding his resignation. You know, many people say, well, he had no other choice. But, you know, traditionally in Guatemala, presidents have had other choices and they've very often put them to use.
So you suggested it was the protests. Is this an example of people power in Guatemala? And where's that energy going to go now?
You know, Guatemala has presidential elections this coming Sunday. And though there are approximately 12 different candidates, there are three principal candidates that are getting most of the votes. And none of those three candidates are really very attractive to the Guatemalan people. And this, you know, this includes working people, middle-class people, and industrialists. So the question will be if these protests can continue to force the new elected leader who will take over in January, you know, a process of greater transparency and honesty.
So we've got to remember this is the first time in Guatemalan history a president has resigned there. Well, the first time in a long time, 1930s maybe there was somebody. It's still a huge moment for the country. Where on the kind of good day scale does this rank, you think, for Guatemala?
The euphoria that was expressed by almost all the sectors in Guatemala life is unique. It's never been felt. If one went to either Twitter or Facebook, you saw constant postings from all sorts of people expressing their joy and their happiness. The fear that I have, and it's a fear that many of my friends in Guatemala also have, is that this euphoria will be momentary and that the reality is that we have an election in 3 days in which none of the candidates are particularly appealing. The leader, Manuel Valdizón, is an industrialist from the Petén region, and he's been accused of trying to buy the support of the congressmen, offering them $61,000 each to support his campaign. Jimmy Morales is a comedian that's a kind of stalking horse for the military. The third leading candidate is Sandra Torres, who was the wife of Álvaro Colom, who was the previous president, and she divorced him 4 years ago in order to run for the presidency herself. And she also has a rather checkered past. You know, so none of the three candidates is really appealing. There's a strong desire among Guatemalans to vote nulo, which is, I guess, to give a blank vote.
Right. What about any of the lesser candidates? Do they have what it takes to blaze a new path for the country?
I don't think so. These are candidates that are getting, according to the latest polls, like 2, 3, 4% of the votes, and none of them seem very appealing.
Writer David Unger, thank you very much for your time and for telling us about what's going on in Guatemala right now.
Thank you.
If you've ever seen Australian rules football, you know it's like rugby, only on a much bigger field and with players that look way more intense. Well, Aussie rules, as it's called, has been gripped by a racism controversy this year. It involves a legendary player who also happens to be Aboriginal. The world's William Troop takes it from there.
Adam Goods isn't just one of the best athletes in Australian rules football. He's the 2014 Australian of the Year. That's not a sports award. It's an honor bestowed on outstanding leaders in Australian society. The award was given not just in recognition of what Goods has accomplished on the pitch, but also as a nod to his Aboriginal roots and his activism on behalf of Indigenous rights. So at the very least, it's sad that every time Goods touches the ball these days, the booing starts.
So Adam Goods, looking for three.
Why this is happening is up for debate in Australia. Some say Goods started it. Back in 2013, in the middle of a game, Goods was involved in a play near the sidelines. After the play, as he walked away, a fan called him an ape. Goods spun around and pointed to the fan, a 13-year-old girl. Security quickly escorted her out of the stands. The next day, Goods said this at a press conference.
Racism has a face last night, and you know, it was a 13-year-old girl, but it's not her fault. It just hit me that it's a society issue, and it's an issue about what are our parents teaching our kids.
That prompted a lot of criticism of Goods from people who said it was inappropriate to pick on a 13-year-old girl to make his point. Then, this year, a new incident. At a game in May, after scoring a goal, Goods celebrated by mimicking an Aboriginal war dance, complete with the gesture of throwing a spear in the direction of the opposing team's fans. In the game footage, you can see those fans start to boo him right then and there. Ironically, it happened during the league's Indigenous round, which is supposed to highlight and honor the contributions of Aboriginals. That is not relevant to those who criticize Goods, like former Aussie Rules player and TV personality Sam Newman. He flat out dismisses the notion that the booing is racist.
How gratuitously stupid is that? I would suggest that the people boo Adam Goods because he's turned their game into a political forum. And people go to the football to get away from everything as a release. They go there to enjoy their side playing football, and if they want to boo, they can.
You can tell by the cheers from the studio audience that he's not the only one who thinks that. And so the booing continues. It's gotten so bad and so focused on Goods personally that he's chosen to sit out some games. He's even rumored to be considering retiring from the sport altogether before the end of the season. The Australian Football League, though, has taken his side. The captains of all 18 AFL teams issued a statement to support Goods, and league CEO Gillon McLachlan underscored that message.
You know, we've had a clear mandate from our industry now that it's zero tolerance to racism. And it's a clear mandate that the treatment of Adam Goods has been unacceptable. And we have to get that respect back in our game.
Many Australian football fans have also gone out of their way to cheer for Goods. And the player is grateful. After coming back to the game a few weeks ago, Goods thanked the league and the fans for their support. And as for all the talk about racism and booing, Good said that's a discussion that Australia needed to have.
People have had their opinions, they've spoken about the issues, and hopefully now we can move forward. And for me, it's about going out there and playing football, and whether this is my last year or not, you know, I really want to be able to go out there and enjoy the last games of the season and then see what happens.
Goods was already considering retirement before the booing started this season. He's 35 and in the twilight of his playing days anyway. But he said that he doesn't want his career to end in controversy. His team, the Sydney Swans, play their final regular season game tomorrow. Then come the playoffs and a chance for Adam Goods to write a different ending on the pitch. For The World, I'm William Troop.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. An estimated 13 million children across the globe can't go to school, mostly due to war and conflict, and the effects may be felt for decades.
Today's teachers are not able to teach tomorrow's teachers. Engineers, doctors, all forms of professions and workers.
That story is coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with support from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system with assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The heartbreaking photo of Aylon Kurdi has been on our minds all week. He was the 3-year-old Syrian boy whose body washed up on a Turkish beach. He and his family were trying to get from Syria to Europe when their crowded boat overturned in the Mediterranean. The family was from Kobani, the town in northern Syria that was besieged by ISIS. Aylon's aunt, Tima Kurdi, lives in Vancouver and had apparently been trying to help the family make it to Canada. She told Canadian TV what it was like when she visited her brother last year in Turkey.
It changed my whole life. It was a really bad situation. I helped them rent a place. No furniture, no nothing.
trips like the one Curdy describes taking can be seen as suspicious by authorities in the West. That's because people visiting family in southern Turkey or Syria or Iraq and people wanting to join ISIS often take the same routes. This has actually become a talking point in the upcoming Canadian elections, as we hear from Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
When his father died in April, Samir Saloom's family in Latakia, Syria, asked him to come back for the funeral. Saloom has been living in Canada for 21 years. But he was afraid about what would happen when he returned here to Montreal.
I'm not afraid to go there in Latakia, you know, because it's safe. But I'm afraid when I come back here, they catch me, ask me why you go there, a million questions. So I may not be able to approve where I was.
Saloom is sitting in the basement of his church in Montreal after taking his daughters to Sunday services. He's a Syrian Christian, a pretty unlikely ISIS recruit. But he worries about a question mark for law enforcement, which could affect his job in telecom. If Prime Minister Stephen Harper is reelected, Saloom could have more to worry about than his reputation. Harper wants to ban travel to certain areas controlled by terrorists, likely parts of Iraq and Syria.
We are talking about the most dangerous places on earth where governance is non-existent and violence is widespread and brutal. There are very few legitimate reasons to go to places like these. And those who go without such legitimate reasons will face the full force of the law.
The concern here, like in other countries, is about Canadians leaving to join ISIS. There have been at least 50 so far. Counter-terror experts say that the idea behind a travel ban is that it's easier to prove someone traveled to a certain place than it is to prove someone took part in terrorist activity overseas. But they still question whether the mandate can be enforced. There are more than 22,000 Syrian immigrants in Canada, almost half of them in the province of Quebec. And Afra Jalabi says they have many personal reasons to visit their home country.
It would be so short-sighted to think that you could create a law that would deal with the complexity of traveling to Syria.
Jalabi is a Syrian expat also in Montreal. She doesn't trust the Canadian government to identify what is or isn't a legitimate reason for visiting Syria. She says pretty much all people traveling to dangerous parts of Syria keep a low profile for their own safety. And she worries all those people will seem suspicious.
If you're going to start sorting between all these people, the formal and non-formal and the journalists and the aid workers and the human rights and the visitors, I mean, that's a huge process and you can't do it, really. And on top of that, to criminalize anybody going there, that is just a sweeping generalization and you're basically isolating the Syrian people further.
Australia enacted a law like this in 2014 and is currently pursuing its first prosecution against a nurse named Adam Brookman. He claims he was driven across rebel lines when he himself was hospitalized and conscripted to ISIS. So things can certainly get complicated. Samir Saloom, the man originally from Latakia, agrees that the Canadian government's concern is genuine. But he wants to know how the government would institute the proposed travel ban fairly.
We have to distinguish between the people they go there just to go with ISIS. All the people, they go to see their family or for a legal reason. So we have to pay attention to this, to know who's going there, why is going there, and to prove this.
It's not easy, he says, but nothing is with a war like this. A representative of Harper's campaign said that the legitimate reasons would be laid out in the regulation, and he said the government would review each traveler individually. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
I'm seeing kids going back to school this week. In my city of Cambridge, the school buses will be starting their new rounds next Tuesday. But in many parts of the Middle East and North Africa, no school today or tomorrow or really anytime soon. So says a new study from UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. Sarah Crow is with UNICEF. She's in New York. How many students are we talking about if you look at the North Africa and the Middle East, Sarah?
In total, we're looking at 13 million children who are out of school across the Middle East and North African region, which is a staggering amount. You know, we're seeing up to 9,000 schools damaged, destroyed in one way or another throughout that region. And we believe this is also one of the reasons that is fueling the refugee crisis
So you see a direct linkage between the high numbers of refugees this summer and those parents wanting to get their kids educated.
What we saw earlier in the summer were a lot of single men, and we're now seeing a dramatic increase in the number of children and women going through. Since the beginning of this year until June, it's already been a 75% increase in the number of children and women going through. And since the beginning of 2014, a quarter of a million children under 18 have been seeking asylum in the EU. So these figures are going up. And of course, we've seen the shocking images, and that sort of pierces the conscience of the world. And we realize now that, or hopefully the world realizes now, that we all have to do much more. And this is waking up the world to act on Syria, but also on the refugee crisis.
A lot of this is about the paralyzed educational system in Syria, but I know that's not the only place that's having problems. You said nearly 9,000 schools across the region can't be used. Where else are students not in school right now?
Well, of course, we've seen the conflict in Yemen has really left a tremendous toll on children's lives there, and that's ongoing. Sudan as well, and of course Gaza. So it's a very wide-ranging problem throughout the Middle East and North Africa, and many of these families, of course, have lost out in several years of education for their children. Children are having to go to class, if they're lucky, in schools which are bombed out, and it's a terrible image for a child to have to endure. A school that should be a safe haven, that should be a place of learning, have often been taken over by rebels, by military forces, and have been turned from places of learning into places of conflict.
I hear your concern, Sarah. What is UNICEF actually doing to ensure these children will have some education?
Well, first and foremost, for the very near future, has to be temporary facilities. And that's what we're stepping up throughout the region. Things like a school in the box. It means temporary shelters where you have, for small children, some basic education, psychosocial support in child-friendly places. For instance, the Syrian refugees, and there are 80% of those going through the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia at the moment, 80% of those are Syrians, and we have a small operation there to support children on the move. But in Syria and in the surrounding areas, it's really beefing up the temporary schooling and really trying to get more children into the existing schools in those countries as well.
10 years down the road, what's the prognosis? I mean, do you even have a situation that kind of compares to this that we can look at and have a sense of what these kids are going to face for the next decade in their lives?
Well, this is not just about these 13 million children. The effect of this is so dramatic on the nations that are affected. Today's teachers are not able to teach children to become tomorrow's teachers. Engineers, doctors, all forms of professions and workers are not going to be coming out of those schools because of this crisis. So it has a domino effect, and it's extremely worrying. It's the future of those nations are at stake, too.
Sarah Crowe is UNICEF's Chief of Crisis Communications. Thank you for your time, Sarah.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
We first heard from Sonita Alizadeh last spring. She's the teenager rapper from Afghanistan who wrote a song about girls there being sold to the highest bidder. Sonita was a 16-year-old bride herself, and that song got her out of that marriage and earned her a scholarship to a prestigious boarding school in Utah. Reporter Shuka Kalantari visited Sonita in Mount Pleasant, Utah, to learn how she's adjusting to life in the States. Shuka joins me on the line from Berkeley to tell us more about Sonita.
Hi, Marco.
Greetings, Shuka. Tell me, first of all, how you first met Sonita.
I actually met Sonita through Facebook. She was having a concert in the Bay Area in California, and I reached out through a mutual friend and did an interview with her, and I've been kind of following her since then.
Tell us about how she got to the U.S. I mean, it was through Iran as a refugee, and then she ends up in Utah. Seems not your usual route.
Exactly. So Sonita and her family fled Afghanistan on foot just because of ongoing conflict there when she was a young girl. And she was a refugee in Iran most of her life. But refugees in Iran don't really have any rights. They can't go to school. They can't own a car. So a nonprofit took her in and taught her some skills, and, you know, one thing led to another. She learned how to rap. She learned music. She had a lot of people along the way to help her, and a group called Strongheart, who actually, you know, helps cultivate kids from around the world, they heard her music video, Daughters for Sale, which is about her almost getting married and, you know, not wanting to, a plea to her family, if you may. You know, that inspired them to help her get a full scholarship to this prestigious boarding school in Mount Pleasant, Utah.
Wow, so a music video basically got her to the United States.
Exactly. So let's hear what she has to say.
Okay. My name is Sonita Alizadeh. I am from Afghanistan. I came to USA 8 months ago. I'm a student at Wasatch Academy, and I'm a singer and rapper about women's and children's rights.
Here's where Sonita switches back to her native Farsi. We go back and forth between the two languages during our conversation. It's called Finglisi, kind of like Spanglish, but for Farsi speakers. One of the first things Sonita did when she landed in Utah was eat pizza. She loves the pizza in the U.S. Sonita says at her new boarding school, they have a massive dining hall, and the students have chefs who cook them pretty much anything they want. But here's the thing. Every time Sonita is in that big old cafeteria and there's some food left over on her plate that ends up getting thrown away, she gets really upset because she knows there's people in Afghanistan and in other poor countries that don't have enough food to eat. She used to be one of those people. When Sonita fled Afghanistan and moved to Iran as a refugee, she went to a school that took in child laborers and people like herself. She usually was hungry, but her teachers would find ways to feed her. They'd bring her lunch to school or invite her to share their own meals. Her new life at her boarding school in Utah is the exact opposite. Sonita says here, everyone eats sushi, all the time. A classmate told her it's one of the more expensive foods in the U.S. Sonita says most of the kids at her school have anything and everything their hearts could desire. They don't really understand what the lives of poor children are like. Like that their leftover food would be an excellent meal for a child who has nothing to eat. But she likes her friends, and she's grateful for her new school.
Wasatch Academy, I think it's a great school to get education and a safe place. And it's a real school to me.
Sonita says what she loves most about her school is singing in the recital hall. It's a converted church, and the acoustics are amazing. Right now, Sonita is eating up all the perks at school, except for the sushi. She tried it once, says it tasted kind of bland. Sonita says she knows it's supposed to be a health food, but health food is apparently kind of boring. Still, her classmates always insist, just try sushi one more time. Maybe you'll like it. But Sonita knows what she likes.
Cheeseburger mikhoram ba chicken and pizza.
And Shuka's back with me now. Shuka, how are we going to follow Sonita's story now and her life now?
Actually, she's doing an audio diary. We at The World, gave her an iPod Touch and kind of just told her to go for it. And she's agreed to let us air her diary and post photos and videos on our blog at The World. So we'll be following her that way and checking in with her, you know, throughout the school year to see how life is going for her, how she's adjusting to life in Utah.
Excellent. We'll be looking forward to that.
And what you're hearing right now is Sonita's song, Daughters for Sale.
The World, Shuka Kalantari, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. I'll talk to you soon.
شاید فرار یا خودکشی از حماقت آدم چاره ای نداره وقتی بی حمایت اما تارتار موهامرم که کنده باشه این کار نمی کنم که سرف کنده باشه اگه فروش ببری شما جای خوشحالیه سعی میکنم دروغ بگم همه چی عالیه مکه از خدا من لبخند باشه بله باشه ما اگه لبخند دارم عوض چه باقی ما شما
Just ahead, what migrants carry with them on their way to Europe is coming up next here on The World.
The World's Global Nation education coverage is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, part of the American Graduate Let's Make It Happen initiative, supporting communities as they work to end the dropout crisis. AmericanGraduate.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. A carton of Winston's, a yellow plastic bag, lemons, a laser pointer, bandages, sunscreen, painkillers, a change of clothes, and a life jacket. These are some of the items in Syrian refugee Abu Janna's bag when he crossed the Mediterranean from Egypt. Photographer Sima Diab recently documented the items that Syrian refugees, including Abu Janna, decided to bring on their journey to Europe.
He's more prepared than most. I think he was thinking more longevity and survival skills than anything else. I mean, he considered the laser pointer, and that was kind of profound for Patrick and I. I mean, he knows the risks in front of him, and so he's packing accordingly.
Right. Patrick is the writer on the story.
Patrick Kingsley is the writer on the story, yeah.
And why did Abu Janna bring a laser pointer?
Sometimes these trips can take 7 to 12 days. And if you're on a rickety boat crossing the Mediterranean, that's an illegal boat. You don't have your regular lights that you would normally have on a boat. And so you're not really drawing attention to yourself. But if something goes wrong, that's the one thing you want to do. The idea that he would take a laser pointer for anybody to see miles or kilometers around was pretty profound.
Hmm. Where was Abu Janna from and what prompted him to ultimately leave Syria?
He is an ex-army officer. He's from the south, and he decided that he didn't want to partake in what he considered a government crackdown on protesters. And so he decided to leave Syria, in effect, defecting from the army.
And how did he know what to pack? Like that laser pointer, is the advice mill now just full of suggestions like bring a laser pen and lemons? They might be lifesavers.
I think lemons is more of something that you find a little more common. The laser pointer, I haven't actually come across before.
Right. And life jackets, does everyone pretty much have one now? Or are they still hard to get?
Yeah, if you've got the money, there's nothing hard to get. Keep in mind what they normally take with them is really quite small. So it's not much more than just a small backpack on their backs. All of these things are very tightly packed inside of that backpack.
Right.
You know, as somebody who travels quite often, I find it often very difficult to kind of cram everything into a carry-on. So the idea that this is all they've got and it's the most important things to them to kind of keep them alive until they get to the other side. And the hope is that when they get to the other side, the worst was behind them. And that as long as they're alive, they can get everything back. They can get clothes, they can get the other things, they can get other necessities.
I gather, Sima, you were just at the train station in Budapest. I'm curious, are these migrants' belongings just as spare now as, say, a few days or a few weeks ago when they first landed?
I'd probably say more so. I mean, we had done a previous story, Patrick and I, on migration called The Journey, about a man who had gone from Syria to Sweden. In that piece, I had also photographed and we had talked to him about the things that he would take with him. He had gone with quite a few things in his backpack, like most of the people do. And yet when he arrived, he had, you know, no more than a handful of things, like a small little notebook. And, you know, when he was asked what happened to them, he kind of laughed and said they're either ruined or lost at sea. So a lot of people end up arriving with a lot less than what they left with. So you can imagine, you know, a pack of cigarettes will go relatively quickly on a 10-day boat ride. The lemons will probably be used. And so what is actually left is the small little stuff, things that would identify him for him to start a new life.
And Sima, was there anything that really surprised you about what any of the people you and Patrick profiled, what they brought?
The lemons was actually really interesting for me because it's a perishable good. In case they don't have water, lemons acts, you know, as a dehydrate yourself a little bit, and it's an anti-nausea. First, I thought, well, why don't they just take, you know, anti-nausea pills? And I realized, well, they might not even have water. And that was an incredible realization that it can get that desperate.
It is so desperate. Sima Diab, she recently profiled, along with Patrick Kingsley for The Guardian newspaper, Syrian refugees and the things they were carrying with them on their journey across the Mediterranean. Sima, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, Magic System. Hommage à Alpha Blondie.
Finally, something online caught my eye and ear the other day. This song. The song is called Sweet Fanta Diallo. The band Magic System from Ivory Coast in West Africa is taking care of business there. I discovered this cool tune at Latitudes, the international music you must hear now. It's a new feature that our friends at NPR.org have set up to listen to vital tracks from the world of global music. NPR's Anastasia Silkes curates Latitudes and joins me from New York. So here's the thing, Anastasia. This is a great reggae-inflected pop tune, but it's not a new song, and Magic System is not a new band. But I gather this tune, Sweet Fanta Diallo, has been a big hit this summer all over West Africa. Who is Magic System and what's their song about?
Well, so this is a band from Abidjan in Ivory Coast, and they have had a string of hits over the last few years. And they are going back for another big summer hit. So this song, Sweet Fanta Diallo, is actually a cover of a much older song by another artist from Ivory Coast named Alpha Blondy. And they give a shout out to him at the beginning of the song. So they really are honoring kind of roots of how music from Ivory Coast has gone international.
I mean, it's basically a crush on a beautiful woman. That's what the song is about, right? A woman named Sweet Fanta Diallo.
Yeah, and what is it? She hugs rainbows, is it?
Yeah.
And you know, there's all this sort of dreamy, very sweet imagery in the song.
Now, the version by Magic System and Alpha Blondy's original version from a bunch of years ago, they bounce the same way. Let's just hear a bit of Alpha Blondy's. Fanta kissed him in one of the burning rocks. But then near the end of Alpha Blondy's original version, this happens. Yeah, at the end he sings, one day Fanta flew away with the sun, the last time I saw her, psychiatric hospital, now I know I did you wrong. Psychiatric hospital, yeah. Now I know I did you wrong. What's going on here?
It takes such a turn, doesn't it? You know, it goes from the sweetness, and there's such an arresting juxtaposition of the seriousness of the lyrics and sort of the sweet bounce of the music. And the funny thing is, in the Magic System version, that doesn't exist.
Why do you think Magic System got away from those complexities?
It may be something as personal or innocuous, however you want to see it, as the fact that Alpha Blondy was maybe singing about his own personal experiences. He did spend time in psychiatric hospitals as a younger man. Maybe that just felt like too much of a biographical element. I also think that maybe it's just that Magic System wanted a big, sort of comfortable sounding hit, because without that sort of edge, you have a very sweet, very catchy pop tune.
Anastasia Silkes of the NPR blog Latitudes. Eric Goldberg composed the world's theme music from the Nana Bill Harris Studios at WGBH. I'm Marco Werman. Have a good one.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH. Brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, the Gruber Family Foundation, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, and the Harold Simmons Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship at skoll.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.